Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news.
What you are about to hear are some highlights
from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drags my senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates of hell, and I will tell them, we will tell them.
Hello.
We have stories from the newswire of GM campaigns, traveller evictions, and a letter from Jimbo, the radical UK graffiti artist who's in Baghdad at the moment. Also, later in the studio, with a bit of luck, we'll have the climbers who were cut off the Auburn Bridge at the Evian G8 summit by the police, as well as a telephone interview with Grattan from the Roma Federation about the wave of evictions that's affecting traveller sites nationwide. Now, unless you've been hiding in a bunker, you'll know that the government is preparing a very limited approval for just one genetically modified crop, GM maize. They will issue permission for it to be grown for one season only. The government's statutory advisor, ACRA, the Advisory Committee on Releases to the Environment, has publicised its interpretation of the results of the GM crop farm-scale evaluations. These four-year tests examine the impact that growing GM crops in the UK might have on wildlife. They specifically compared damage to wildlife caused by weed control in GM crops fields with weed control associated with conventional crops. In essence, the tests examined the impact of different chemical herbicide use rather than the GM crops themselves. ACRA advised government that two crops, GM beet and oilseed rape, could have a detrimental effect on wildlife if they were grown commercially in the UK. However, ACRA also advised that GM maize would not adversely impact on the environment if it was grown in the same way that it was during the farm scale evaluations. ACRA's advice effectively gives GM maize approval for commercial use. However, atrazine, the pesticide used on conventional maize and in the trials, is now to be banned. The chemical which effectively sterilises the soil is responsible for the poor performance of the maize against its GM counterpart in the official trials. The plan, which will be announced next month, is widely believed to be designed to save Tony Blair from abandoning the technology while trying to contain public outrage by ensuring that few controversial crops will be actually planted. In order for GM maize to be grown beyond the limited one-season term, the industry will have to prove its case all over again with a new set of studies to show that growing its product remains more beneficial than traditional cultivation, even after the pesticide atrazine has been replaced. Critics of the farm-scale trials say that conditions were designed to give the modified crop the best possible environmental performance, making it uneconomic in the real world. Senior officials expect there will be no market for GM maize and believe it will only be grown if biotech farms give farmers offers they cannot refuse. Commenting on the publication of ACRA's advice, Greenpeace campaigner Sarah North said, "ACRA's advice on GM maize is bad for farmers, bad for the organic food industry, and bad for our countryside. The only reason GM maize got through the British tests was because its impact on wildlife was compared to that of conventional maize, which is managed using a chemical herbicide which is so toxic it has now been banned throughout Europe." North continued, "If you compare one bad practice with an even worse practice, of course the result is that the former looks better than the latter. It's like recommending a holiday in Baghdad on the basis that it might be safer than Chechnya." For more information, see www.greenpeace.org.uk.
Following last week's story about the Traveller site in Bulkington resisting eviction, another similar situation is brewing. Anne Connor, a young pregnant woman, registered herself as homeless this week because Chelmsford Borough Council is bent on evicting her from her caravan park, along with 30 other travellers, at Meadowlands Caravan Park in Little Waltham. The council is not only intent on evicting all 30, but also bulldozing the entire park. Around 35 supporters, including travellers from Essex and Bedfordshire, have already pledged to come to Meadowlands on Sunday, January the 25th, and stay overnight to oppose and stop the eviction, which is due to start at 8 a.m. on Monday morning. The site at Meadowlands now has deep ditches and high earth banks dug around it, protecting it. The National Travellers Action Group believes that by peacefully resisting such evictions, local councils will be persuaded against using force and the government will be forced to make it easier for travellers to set up caravan parks. Currently, they say 98% of planning applications are turned down. The travellers from last week's story have now won the right in the High Court to a judicial review of their case, successfully protecting their site until the review can be heard. If the council had been successful in an attempt at eviction, the council had planned to repossess the land in order to pay for the costs of the eviction. Last weekend, around 50 people took part in a theatrical protest around Northwood Military HQ. Sorry, I've jumped stories. Now we have a telephone interview with...
We have a telephone interview with Gretton from the Roma Federation. Are you there, Gretton?
I'm here, yeah.
Hi. I was talking to you last week about what's happening in Chelmsford with the eviction. What is the legal situation for the travellers there?
Well, the legal situation is that no planning permission has been given for this caravan site. However, there is another site just up the road which has been put there by Chelmsford Council, and presumably they've given themselves planning permission for that one, but are refusing to give it for the one that we're worried about the Meadowlands caravan site.
How long has Meadowlands been in existence?
It's been there for a couple of years. It was previously owned by another lot of travellers and then was sold on to the present residents.
So the travellers, once again, like with last week's situation, they own their land. It's their land.
Yep, they own the land, yes.
And so basically they're not being given permission to live on the land that they own.
That's right, because of Green Belt. Because, you know, there's vast government schemes for enormous housing projects down the Thames Valley area, which this is pretty close to, for building houses, 12 billion housing schemes. And all we're asking the government is to include caravan sites really in part of that scheme, because travellers have got nowhere to go.
And you were telling me earlier a bit about how you were going to appeal to the police on the basis of dealing with the travellers as a specific ethnic group. Could you clarify that for me?
Yeah, well, going back a little bit, we feel there's a great big wave of racism against travellers, against Rom, against gypsies. We've had the murder last year of Johnny Delaney, a racist attack up in Cheshire, and we've had gypsies burned in effigy down in Sussex. We've had the Cowes Road caravan site bulldozed, and a lot of bulldozing going on at Woodside caravan site, with half of which was saved. And now we have this thing at Meadowlands, and as you saw last week, Burlington Fields, the travellers there just said, we are not going to be moved. We've got nowhere to go to, and we're going to dig in, and they did. And the bailiffs were stopped in their tracks there. So we hope by doing the same on Monday morning to wake up the government, and this is a kind of wake-up call to the government to step in and say the legislation has to be changed. It has to be made easier for people to buy a piece of land and get on and provide a caravan site for themselves.
And will the eviction need support? Would you like people to go to Chelmsford to kind of offer solidarity with the travellers there?
We do indeed, yes. We've got to about 60 people pledging to come up on Sunday. We've got a marquee. We've got a kitchen going to be set up there. There'll be lots of room in the trailers for people to stay overnight, and we hope they'll rally around us.
How can people get to Chelmsford? What are the directions?
Just go to Chelmsford Station, and then you can get a short lift out to Meadowlands, about 10 minutes from the centre of Chelmsford.
And do you have a website where people can check up?
Not a website, but I could probably give out a telephone number, which would give them... Anybody rings this telephone number, we'll get a lift from Chelmsford Station out to Meadowlands.
Yeah, that's fine.
Would that be good?
That would be brilliant. It will go out across the whole of London, so...
All right. Just call Jim...
Okay.
...on 0787-669-7015, and you can get a lift out to Meadowlands caravan site, and trailers are there for staying over the night, and as I say, we've got a marquee up. There'll be food there. We should have a good time. And I think we're also going to be successful on Monday morning in
resisting,
stopping this eviction.
Okay. Well, good luck. Hopefully people will see you there. I'll just read that telephone number one more time. That's 0787-669-7015. That's if anyone wants to offer solidarity. And you'll get a lift from Chelmsford to Meadowlands. Thanks a lot, and hopefully we'll speak to you next week.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
Trustees have a few suggestions they would like to submit to you.
I think you know what the trustees can do with their suggestions. I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
He's opposed to it. In fact, indeed, he's opposed to it.
For months before my son was born, I used to yell from night till morn, whatever it is, I'm against it. And I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.
Well, I'm against it.
And last week, around 50 people took part in a theatrical protest around Northwood Military HQ, enacting what they called the Bloody History of Northwood. The activists assembled at Northwood Tube Station and walked up to Northwood HQ. Police blocked the passage on public streets through the MOD housing next to the base and forced the procession to take a longer turn round the base. In different places, different scenes from Northwood's bloody history were played out. On the first police barricade, a scene relating to Northwood's role in the Falklands War, 1982. The next stop was dedicated to Operation Desert Fox, the four-day bombing of Iraq in 1998. As the procession passed the main gate, where heavy policing of the theatrical event was all too obvious. At Pretty Corner, the scene of police abuse at the last Reclaim the Bases weekend in April 2003, the war on terrorism was acted out while a fictitious military briefing looked at possible future interventions. Elsewhere on Monday, three activists blockaded the main gate at RNAD Coalport, the storage facility for Trident nuclear warheads. Morag from Faslane Peace Camp, Roz, a Trident Ploughshares pledger from Edinburgh, and Raggy Jason from Bristol blockaded the main gate at Coalport for 2.5 hours from 6:55 a.m. till 9:25 a.m. Workers' traffic tailed back and eventually a subsidiary gate was opened to which police redirected traffic further along the road. It took some time for the MOD cutting team to cut the three free in the pouring rain from two steel lock-on tubes using a steel cutting saw. All three were arrested for breach of the peace and held for a few hours. One of the activists said, "Only weapons of non-existence have so far been found in Iraq. Meanwhile, the UK blatantly stores and loads WMD from here, ready to be used at any time against innocent civilians in any country deemed to be a threat. We ask, whose interests are being served here?"
War Resisters International, the international pacifist network which affiliates in 40 countries, is being taken to court by the Inland Revenue for refusing to pay war tax. Nice one. In September 2001, the WRI Council meeting in Turkey called for conscientious objection to war and preparation for war, including refusal to pay war tax. In December 2001, the War Resisters International executive decided to withhold the proportion of the staff's income tax used to fund war. Since then, every quarter, WRI withholds 7% of the income tax and puts it into a separate fund. The case is for withheld income tax for the financial year 2002-03, a total of £447.55 plus interest. War Resisters International maintains that it is the right of their staff to refuse paying for war if they have a conscientious objection to military taxation. The case will be heard on February the 9th. For more information on this case, see wri-rig.org.
A Turin samba band player walked free from Horse Ferry Road Magistrates Court in London 2 weeks ago. All charges against Francisco were dropped when four police officers failed to appear in court to justify the charges. He was facing three counts of assaulting police officers after an incident outside the Lancaster Gate Hotel at the Dicey Arms Fair Delegates Dinner, which was held on September the 11th last year. Francisco was arrested when riot police attacked a group playing samba and others, beating them back off the road opposite the hotel. Over 3 years ago, in December 2000, the government of Turkey sent in thousands of soldiers and police into over 20 of the country's prisons. The aim was to force inmates into new isolation prisons. 28 prisoners were killed and hundreds wounded during this process. Hunger strikes in protest at the attack and against extreme forms of prison isolation have continued since then. In all, 107 people have lost their lives opposing the prison policies of Turkey's government, and the deaths are continuing. Protests have continued outside prisons as well, and also outside Turkey, in countries like Britain, which have a sufficient Turkish-speaking minority. A 45-day hunger strike in a tent started on December the 22nd near Seven Sisters Underground at the junction of High Road with Seven Sisters. Several people there are on hunger strike throughout this period, while others are on hunger strike for shorter lengths of time. The aim is to increase public awareness of the highly oppressive
prison policies of Turkey's government and to register opposition. Despite a racist stabbing at one of the Seven Sisters' hunger strikes on January the 6th, he and the others will pursue the protest to the end. A rally outside the tent where people have now been on hunger strike for over 30 days is to take place at 2 p.m. this Saturday, January the 24th.
Get a little bit of action. Dep up on the mic, dep up on the mic. What? Dep up on the mic, up on the boom selection. Tell Tony Blair, the one in fair. Tell Tony Blair, we're gonna mash him up at the election. We told Tony Blair, but Tony Blair, it just don't care. So Tony Blair, we got him out of insurrection. Show my sound to the American. Show them my sound, but please tell them we don't hate them, we still love them. Nasty niggas spell off off a dot cotton. And America is basically our children, but things can't run, so please tell them we don't hate them, we still love them, but things can't run, so please tell them. Big up the massive Armageddon FM. Big up Stink Finger, big up Dylan. Tell George Galloway, big up Red Ken. Even Frank Dobson wanted to mash up the system. Out of them I like Jeremy Corbyn. And Kenneth Clark Kent should be leading Thatcher's men. But Robin Cook the baddest out of all of them. Robin Cook the manest out of all of them. Robin Cook the only man who hold his head above the system. Robin Cook the baddest out of all of them. Well, gotta get a little bit. And gotta ever get it, gotta get a little bit of action. Dep, dep up on the mic, dep up on the mic, what? Dep up on the mic, up on the boom selection. Tell Tony Blair, what if it'll tell Tony Blair, we're gonna mash him up at the election. Tell Tony Blair, the what if it'll tell Tony Blair, we're gonna mount the insurrection.
Comrades, I only have for a few moments. We are here today to found a new political movement worldwide. The biggest demonstration ever in Britain.
This one for the Texas crew.
The first global demonstration.
Don't listen to Fox News.
A new political movement. It must be about the establishment of a Palestinian state.
You're either with us or against
it
us.
It must be.
Vote Carol Moseley Brown. Is it Moseley Braun? You know who I'm talking about. But don't pay no attention to Fox News, trust me. Conscious crew. Big issue mob, yeah? This one's special for you, straight out. You're the only ones who get this one. Here come the rock.
That bring us all to Hyde Park this afternoon. Thank you for listening.
Well, that was that was from Peace Not War, Visionary Underground. And now we have in the studio Martin Shaw and Gazine Wenzel. And Martin Shaw and Gazine Wenzel, for those who follow the Indie Media website, will know that they did an action during the Evian G8 summit last year where they hung off the bridge to try and blockade the delegates from getting to the G8 meeting. And a very nice policeman actually cut Martin's rope, so he fell over 30 metres. And Gazin, who was also balancing the rope on the other side with Martin, was basically left watching in horror as Martin fell and had to be pulled up. So we had a meeting last night at Lark where they both presented a film about what happened and about the legal situation that is kind of growing out of the police action. And it was quite a good discussion last night. I just wondered, do you want to tell us a little bit about basically what's happening to you legally since you were cut off the bridge?
So, very ironically, we're actually being charged with closing the road and endangering life, but the police who cut us down haven't been charged. They're still under investigation. But the purpose of the discussion last night was, as there's a growing wave of repression both on the streets from the police and in the Parliament, both in the UK and EU, there's more and more repressive legislation. What we're talking about last night is how to actually form communities of resistance, how we can start supporting each other through these traumas that unfortunately sometimes happen. Although thousands of people go on these demonstrations, most people don't get hurt and have a very empowering experience. Some people will either get physically hurt or have emotional trauma.
And you were hurt. What were your injuries, Martin?
Well, my physical injuries were a broken back, a broken pelvis and a sort of badly broken foot.
And Gazin, what happened to you? How were you affected by the incident?
I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorders during quite a long time, and I'm just getting now over it, really.
So what's the way forward for you guys with this case?
Fortunately, we have a very good lawyer. Unfortunately, we're fighting a horrendously biased legal system whereby the judge has almost failed completely to investigate. So the way forward is this legal process, which can help, but the way forward is to start spreading this idea that what will be a benefit from this case if we can spread this idea of people supporting each other, understanding these processes happen, understanding about post-traumatic stress disorder, understanding that support is not just in the immediate weeks or months after an incident, but sometimes take months or years for people to overcome these in both a physical and a mental way. So that's very important for us.
Yeah, because I think you see people coming back from summits that it is very traumatic. The police are given free rein to be quite violent in various countries. I mean, we saw in G8, we saw people that were tortured and somebody killed. And so what you're really saying is that we have to set up some sort of network so that when people come back, there's someone there to help mm-hmm. them get over seeing that level of violence and that level of abuse.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we try and organise on this kind of level because it's something that we always seem to forget. Like, people come back from these summits and they're traumatised, and when you're traumatised, then you don't really want to be in big groups of people and talk about it and stuff. You really need quite personal support, and you need people who understand you and people who work you through it and this kind of stuff. And this is something that we miss very often. And I think it's very important that we diffuse more information about this kind of topic and that we actually really work on it when we come back from these things, because if not, in the end, they're going to win and their repression is going to win if we don't learn how to deal with that.
And you two are touring the film around the UK of what's been happening. It was quite a good video, actually, about Alban Bridge. And it just showed the kind of complete ineptitude of the police. And you're taking that on tour around the UK. Where are you going with that video?
So Derby, Nottingham, Manchester, Leeds, Bradford, Sheffield.
And you're hoping to kind of encourage the various groups that you speak to there to set up support networks for activists?
It's not really clear. It's an evolving situation. So really just gauging the opinions. Different ideas are going to come up each time, I think, which is brilliant. So we haven't got all that different inputs. Yesterday, the idea of having a database of trained counsellors who are experienced with working with people of this political nature. Gazina was trying to find a counsellor who was basically trying to counsel her out of being mad enough to go and try and challenge the system, which is, you know, clearly the last thing you want when you're recovering from very genuine stress from these situations. And there's very obvious situations, like for me and Gazina, but the less obvious things are the other people on that action, the other people, some of which we know very well, some of which we don't know so well, and they are probably suffering from the fallout of this, but there's a focus on sort of the very obvious cases, and there's lots of much less serious, obvious trauma, but it's accumulative and it's there. And if it's not dealt with, then it's likely to come out in anger and frustration or fear and disempowerment at a later date.
OK, well, good luck with your tour, and it was lovely to have you. Thanks very much. We're going a track.
And just want to mention that some of the tracks, not all of them, but most of them are coming from a Peace Not War CD, which was given out free with the big issue this week. So get down to your local vendor and buy a copy. Some more tracks later on. Last week, more than 20 people in Oxford joined others across the country to fast in solidarity with asylum seekers who were kept destitute by government policy, namely Section 55. Since the 8th of January 2003, asylum seekers who are judged by the Home Office to have failed to make their application for asylum quickly enough to get no support at all, and they are not allowed to work. Between July and September, 2,810 people nationally were put in this position. Almost one-fifth of those applying. In addition, others are made destitute because their support has been terminated in error or because they have lost their claim. in some cases, that's not the asylum seekers who have lost their claim, it's the government departments dealing with the claims. In some cases, it is too dangerous for them to be returned to their country. The situation in Congo, for instance, is so bad that the government hasn't sent anyone back there for at least 12 months. David Blunkett argues that it makes nonsense of the asylum application procedure if people are allowed to work while applying for asylum or once their application has failed. But if in practice they're allowed to remain. But campaigners and several MPs say the way the law is now being applied is markedly different to the way the legislation was presented when Parliament voted it through. Campaigners have set up several support networks to help asylum seekers. Asylum Welcome, an organisation in Oxford, receives between 25 and 40 visits a month from asylum seekers who are destitute.
A few weeks ago, the US started photographing and fingerprinting any foreigners arriving in the US, apart from European tourists. This is supposedly to stop terrorism, although this scheme seems unlikely to deter potential suicide bombers. In an extremely fair and comical response, Brazil has decided that all Americans arriving in Brazil should be fingerprinted as well, with the simple reasoning that if Brazilians have to be fingerprinted, then why not Americans? Never one for a sense of humour, the US government is more than a bit miffed. The US embassy in Brazil has stated, "We regret the way in which new procedures have suddenly been put in place that single out US citizens for exceptional treatment that has meant lengthy delays in processing. We will continue to raise our concerns with the Brazilian government regarding equitable treatment for US citizens travelling to Brazil." Equitable treatment, eh? Perhaps the US government needs a dictionary as badly as it needs a sense of humour. One American pilot has already been arrested in Brazil. When being photographed and asked if he could be fingerprinted, he raised his middle finger in the universal gesture of insult. His company, American Airlines, has agreed to pay the subsequent $12,000 fine and issue an apology. 10 other crew members were denied entry to Brazil after causing problems during identity checks.
A hunt saboteur was taken unconscious to hospital last Saturday with extensive injuries after being hit by a horse at the Crawley and Horsham hunt in Sussex. Shortly before dusk, at about 4:20, the hunt was chasing a fox that had run down a bridle path. Protesters were running down the right of way when Simon Wilde was allegedly deliberately ridden at by a member of the hunt and then dragged 100 yards by the horse before being left injured on the ground. He was taken to hospital in an ambulance and suffered a broken nose, broken tooth, lacerations and bruising across his face, bruising all over his body as well. He is also suspected to have concussion. A member of the hunt was arrested by the officers at the scene, but only after the protester's wife insisted that police take immediate action. 40 police were in attendance at the meet in Shipley, Sussex, and focused their attention on curtailing the activities of the protesters who were determined to stop the hunt killing foxes using non-violent tactics such as blowing hunting horns and masking the hunted animal's scent with sprays. The Hunt Saboteurs Association says the hunt has a history of violence and threats against protesters, but the hunt denies this. Nathan Brown, a Hunt Sab spokesperson, said, "I challenge the hunting fraternity to condemn this behaviour and doubt very much whether they will, effectively giving it tacit approval."
Right, now we have a letter from a graffiti artist called Jimbo, who went to Baghdad to do various things, to help street kids and things like that. And we have a letter from him, and he was jailed a couple of weeks ago for putting a graffiti of Sinbad dropping bombs onto Baghdad, this kind of graffiti stencil. He was jailed a couple of weeks ago by the Americans for 3 days. But we have another update from him, and it starts like this. "Jailed again, Iraqi Nick this time, was trying to spray a life-size image of two street kids selling cigarettes from a stall onto old communications tower, which is rent with bomb holes and charred and blackened. Anyway, there I was in central Baghdad in the middle of the night with a young journalist flatmate who came along perceiving some story value in the expedition. All ready to go with stencil, spray cans and duct tape when I see a silhouetted figure on the roof of a nearby building, which also hosts a sangar, improvised shelter fortified with sandbags. It occurs to me that my rolled-up meter-long stencil card might look like a rocket launcher, so I walk behind a building to unroll it. Approaching the canvas afresh with a huge bit of card, which looks pretty innocuous to me, here one learns everything unusual is suspicious. I see that now there are at least two guys on the roof, and they are shouting at me. I turn and walk casually back the way I've come, cursing the wasted time, the bad luck they weren't there the night before when I wrecked the area, and calling on every ounce of discipline not to just burst into a sprint. When the first couple of shots come down, there is nothing to lose by running, so we bolt like two scalded cats. The road takes us round another building between us in the firing and screaming, God knows whose, and straight back into their line of fire again. More shots and we do an S-bend down an alley. Now the armed idiots in Baghdad are a bit like stray dogs, both lurk in shadows in packs after dark, and as soon as one starts barking, the rest of them chime from all directions until there's the most god-awful cacophony. Unfortunately, these are 7.62 long rounds we're hearing from weapons in the hands of jittery, trigger-happy people who handle their firearms with about as much skill and training and professionalism as a monkey might. My hope is to weave back up onto the square where we started, get into the first cab and be gone, where three nervous shouting people head us off in the alley and are rapidly joined by more and more. The confusion and panic on their part increases in step with the swelling numbers. I rip off my Arab headscarf to show my ponytail, but in two minds about whether to shout Brittany, yet as I don't know if it's police, resistant fighters, or just thieves, who range from the taxi guy who overcharges to murderous kidnappers and looters. I turn around, spread my arms, dropping my poor crumpled stencil, and walk slowly backwards towards them, attempting to satisfy contradictory orders of come here and don't move. Tom does the same, and we're quite close as we start to sink to the ground. Slowly, one of the brighter sparks gets the idea and shouts, get down, get down. There are others who obviously don't watch TV and get nervous by even this amount of movement and start yelling to us to get up, jabbing away with their weapons, but they're outvoted and retreat to the shadows to sulk and let the pros who've seen the movies show how it's done. I end up face down in an alley with someone's foot on my back and the muzzle of his Kalashnikov nuzzling snugly in my ear hole. I say, old fellow, do you mind? I manage to squeak out a quiet, sorry, Tom. Before long, we're hauled up again with a blue shirt and a laminated card. Basically, the story goes on. He gets arrested by bank security guards and then gets arrested by the police and then gets taken to court. And then they realise that there's no charges against him and they just let him go.
And our next story, back home. Nine Ladies Anti-Quarry Camp was set up back in 1999 to help stop the destruction of Stanton Moor Hillside in the Peak District National Park, which is under threat from the possible reopening of two dormant quarries. The quarries would have a disastrous impact on the Nine Ladies Stone Circle and local wildlife, and camp residents have always vowed to stay until the quarry plans are shelved. But on December the 12th, quarry company Stancliffe Stone submitted a scheme for reopening works on the two quarries to the Peak District National Park Authority. Stancliffe wants to extract 3.2 million tonnes of rock from a site within 100 metres of the Nine Ladies Stone Circle. The quarry company has now also told local papers they plan to begin an eviction process against the camp almost immediately. Campers are calling for reinforcements from around the country. As fast as they can get people out, we hope others from around the country will be getting in across fields, etc.
And now an extract from the weekly alternative news sheet, Schnews. The powers available to the government and state agencies would be truly draconian. Cities could be sealed off, travel bans introduced, all phones cut off, and websites shut down. Demonstrations could be banned and the news media be made subject to censorship. New offences against the state could be created by government decree. At a stroke, democracy could be replaced by totalitarianism, says Tony Bunyan from State Watch. Just when you thought New Labour would run out of new laws to keep us all in line, along comes the mother of them all, the Civil Contingencies Bill. This is, we are told, for our own safety, to help with those little emergencies in life such as terrorist attack, contamination of land with harmful biological, chemical or radioactive matter or oil, and flooding and disruption or destruction of plant or animal life. In such an emergency, forget the yellow pages, because your phone would probably be cut off. Instead, everything would be done to protect or restore the activities of Her Majesty's government, and that means some rather uncivil powers could be invoked. These include the banning of the movement of people and vehicles in any area, evacuation orders of an area, the seizure, confiscation or destruction of property with or without compensation, destruction of animal or plant life with or without compensation, ban of assemblies of specified kinds at specified places or at specified times, shutting down phone lines and websites, arresting people who fail to cooperate with emergency powers. And this is just a watered-down version from a few months back. While New Labour and the media have promoted these powers to deal with floods and such like, Schnews reckons that these powers could be used against members of the public who complain far too much for their own good. Just look at the way anti-stalking laws, which were originally touted to protect women from stalkers, were first used against animal rights activists, and which Bayer are now using to silence critics of their genetically modified crops. Or the terrorism laws, supposedly introduced to protect us from being blown up, which are now routinely used at demos to stop and search anti-war campaigners who have been asking their government not to blow people up. For more info and heavyweight analysis on the much amended Civil Contingencies Bill, see www.statewatch.org. And that was an extract from this week's Schnews. For more, see www.schnews.org.uk.
And now a quick reminder of two events set for the end of the month. The evening of Friday the 30th of January sees an evening of report backs and discussion around the UN World Summit on the Information Society, WSIS, held in Geneva at the end of last year. While Saturday, the 31st, sees an afternoon and evening devoted to ideas and practical initiatives for developing the Indie Media London project. To start things off, there will be short presentations about related projects like, for example, Hack Labs, Culture Jamming and Wireless Projects, followed by a discussion. That starts at midday and runs until 6 p.m, and after that in the evening there will be some short film screenings. Both events are at Limehouse Town Hall, 646 Commercial Road, London E14. For more details of these events, see the London section of the Indie Media UK website.
And Ken Loach introduces a special showing of Bread and Roses about Mexican immigrant women janitors in downtown Los Angeles tomorrow, Thursday the 22nd, at 6:30 p.m. at the Other Cinema, Rupert Street, W1. All money raised will be spent fighting sweatshops in the UK and in Mexico. And finally, Fight the Power, a hip-hop benefit night for the squatted community St. Agnes Place, takes place this Friday at the Telegraph Brixton Hill. Entry is a fiver. P.S. Next week we'll bring you reports from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and the massive counter event, the World Social Forum, just finishing now in Mumbai in India. Remember to get in touch with us about the show for any comments. You can email rilnewswire@ziplip.com. Okay, and now our outro.
Our outro today is to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday, which was last week, the 15th. It's from a US on the web radio program called Democracy Now, and it features some of Martin Luther King's speeches. And probably if you substitute Iraq for Vietnam, it probably holds true 30 years later.
Hooray!
Goodbye, right. Everybody.
Bye-bye.
It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today.
Today is the federal holiday celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. He would have been 75 years old. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the federal holiday celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. It took the government 15 years to create this federal holiday, but it wasn't for another 16 years that New Hampshire became the last state in the nation to celebrate the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King on this federal holiday. Today, we bring you two of Dr. King's speeches. Dr. King, the leading civil rights activist of the century. He led the battle for desegregation in Birmingham, the March on Washington in 1963, the March for Voting Rights in Selma, Alabama. But if you get your history solely from television, you might think that he took a sabbatical between 1965 and 1968, yet he was speaking out and organizing more than ever. All of those speeches were filmed and taped, but they're not shown on television. After passage of the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, King began challenging the nation's fundamental priorities. He maintained that civil rights laws were empty without human rights, including economic rights. For people too poor to eat at a restaurant or afford a decent home, King said anti-discrimination laws were hollow. By 1967, King had also become the country's most prominent opponent of the Vietnam War, and a staunch critic overall of U.S. foreign policy, which he deemed militaristic in his Beyond Vietnam speech delivered at New York's Riverside Church on April 4, 1967, a year to the day before he was murdered. King called the United States, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Time magazine called the speech, quote, demagogic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi. And the Washington Post declared that King had, quote, diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people. Today we bring you an excerpt of that major address, Beyond Vietnam. Dr. Martin Luther King.
This is the message of the great Buddhist leaders of Vietnam. Recently, one of them wrote these words, and I quote, each day the war goes on, the hatred increases in the heart of the Vietnamese and in the hearts of those of humanitarian instinct. The Americans are forcing even their friends into becoming their enemies. It is curious that the Americans, who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory, do not realize that in the process they incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism, unquote. We continue, there will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam. We do not stop our war against the people of Vietnam immediately. The world would be left with no other alternative than to see this as some horrible, clumsy, and deadly game we have decided to play. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. It demands that we admit that we have been wrong from the beginning of our adventure in Vietnam, that we have been detrimental to the life of the Vietnamese people. The situation is one in which we must be ready to turn sharply from our present ways in order to atone for our sins and errors in Vietnam. We should take the initiative in bringing a halt to this tragic war. I would like to suggest five concrete things that our government should do immediately to begin the long and difficult process of extricating ourselves from this nightmarish conflict. Number one, end all bombing in North and South Vietnam. Number two, declare a unilateral ceasefire in the hope that such action will create the atmosphere for negotiation. Three, take immediate steps to prevent other battlegrounds in Southeast Asia by curtailing our military buildup in Thailand and our interference in Laos. Four, realistically accept the fact that the National Liberation Front has substantial support in South Vietnam and must thereby play a role in any meaningful negotiations and any future Vietnam government. Five, set a date
that we will remove all foreign troops from Vietnam in accordance with the 1954 Geneva Agreement, part of our ongoing... commitment might well express itself in an offer to grant asylum to any Vietnamese who fears for his life under the new regime, which included the Liberation Front. Then we must make what reparations we can for the damage we have done. We must provide the medical aid that is badly needed, making it available in this country if necessary. Meanwhile, we in the churches and synagogues have a continuing task while we urge our government to disengage itself from a disgraceful commitment. We must continue to raise our voices and our lives if our nation persists in its perverse ways in Vietnam. We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible. As we counsel young men concerning military service, we must clarify for them our nation's role in Vietnam and challenge them with the alternative of conscientious objection. Say that this is a path now chosen by more than 70 students at my own alma mater, Morehouse College, and I recommend it to all who find the American course in Vietnam a dishonorable and unjust one. Moreover, I would encourage all ministers of draft age to give up their ministerial exemptions and seek status as conscientious objectors. These are the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions, but we must all protest. Now that is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam.